Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again, and welcome to As It Is from VOA Learning English. I'm Jonathan Evans in Washington. Today, we have two stories related to education. Mario Ritter will tell us about a non-governmental organization that helps students in Kenya who are blind or visually impaired. We will have more on that story later in the program. But first, the United Nations Children's Fund says conflicts around the world are affecting a growing number of boys and girls. UNICEF officials say one in four school-age children in conflict areas are not being educated. Ashley Thompson has more.
Nearly 24 million children around the world are unable to attend school because of conflict. That is what UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund, said recently. UNICEF officials studied 22 countries affected by conflict. The UN agency found that nearly one in four of the more than 109 million kids of primary and lower secondary school age who live in conflict zones are missing out on their education. Lisa Binder is an education specialist with UNICEF. She says not only are more children affected by conflict, but conflicts are lasting longer. She adds that children are missing important years for learning.
We're primarily talking about the key ages between 6 and 15. So this doesn't even count children who are missing early learning opportunities. We're really talking about primary school through lower secondary school, the key years for learning.
The results, Binder says, are that children are not able to get the skills they need to survive.
We mean that they won't have the skills that they need to access the job market. They won't have the basic skills that they need to negotiate life. In the countries where we have seen children access education in small villages in Afghanistan, for example, where I visited, these children play a crucial role in negotiating contracts for their parents, being able to understand how to get good prices at the local market.
If children grow up without these skills, Binder says, countries suffer in the long term. Economies and public health could worsen, while girls become more vulnerable to sex abuse. Conflicts are fueling huge population movements in some areas, including the Middle East. Syria is the country largely driving Europe's migrant and refugee crisis. Lisa Binder says Syria once had most of its boys and girls in school. Now, she says, it is difficult to get information on the subject.
We've seen many children in Syria who are now not able to attend school because of the conflict, but there's been such a huge population movement, as you know, into the surrounding countries and now the European migrant crisis, that it's hard to say exactly how many of those children are accessing learning opportunities, if they're formal or non-formal. We're doing our best to provide services with many partners for those children, but it's very hard to get a specific number.
UNICEF says Africa's newest nation, South Sudan, is at the top of the list of countries where conflict is disrupting education. Over half of its children, 51%, are out of school. Niger and Sudan are also near the top of the list. UNICEF says Afghanistan has made progress, but 40% of its children are out of school. UNICEF and its partners are calling on donors and governments to help make education a major part of humanitarian efforts in conflict zones.
We need to shift our attitude from saying we'll get back to school when things calm down to saying that we can't afford to let education stop.
I'm Ashley Thompson.
You are listening to As It Is from VOA, Learning English. In Kenya, a non-governmental organization is helping blind students and those who have trouble seeing. The NGO, called Enable, is offering teaching materials in audio form. Students are saying the teaching technology is less costly than traditional Braille books. Mario Ritter has the story.
In Kenya, blind students and those with poor eyesight were still using Braille books for their studies until recently. Their books used the Braille system of raised dots to represent words and numbers. Those with limited or no eyesight can read by touching those markings. But Kenyan schools for the blind are now beginning to use technology that provides material in an audible form. This has expanded possibilities for the students and taught them new ways to interact with technology. 17-year-old Lucas Mwanzia is visually impaired. For the past 2 years, he has been attending computer classes at the Thika School for the Blind. Lucas Mwanzia is in eighth grade. He started school at a later age because of his poor eyesight. But using the new technology, he can search the internet for biology class. He says the technology has opened doors that once were closed. He says that Braille books are costly, and you have to spend a lot of money to buy one. With computers, he says, the books are available at little or no cost. So, we download the books to read, and when we are done, we just close the program, he says. The school started using assistive technology 6 years ago. It enables blind and visually impaired students to get information from computers and iPads. Zachary Mwasia was born blind. He is now one of the school's teachers. He has been teaching the students how to use the technology for about 2 years now. He says the technology opens up possibilities that can level the playing field for his students. Assistive technology equips the learners with very many skills that really make them independent in life, says Mwasia. They can read materials like books, magazines, newspapers, by themselves. And, apart from that, assistive technology equips them with employable skills. The assistive technology costs $1,000 to set up. But a non-governmental organization called Enable has provided it to the schools at no cost. Peter Okeyo, the program manager at Enable, says blind students using the technology may still face difficulties when they move to higher education. He says students who have used the technology up through high school might not have it at the university they attend. Those students might have difficulties if they have to go back to Braille, he adds. 4 of Kenya's 11 schools for the blind are using the technology. Enable says it will provide the financing for the remaining schools to join the effort. I'm Mario Ritter.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow for another As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans. Thanks for listening.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Economics Report. Russia's economy is struggling at the beginning of 2016. Low oil prices and Western sanctions against Russia continue to affect the country's economy. Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev thinks the economy is looking better than 1 year ago. But he told a conference this week that Russia must prepare for the worst-case scenario. In such a case, conditions would worsen, not improve. Medvedev spoke in Moscow at the yearly Gaidar Forum on Economics. He noted that 2015 was probably the most difficult year for Russia economically in the past 10 years. The level of economic activity shrank 3.8% last year. Two main reasons for this were the sharp drop in the price of oil and Western economic sanctions. Oil is Russia's main export. Its price has dropped about 70% to $30 a barrel over the past 12 months. Western countries placed sanctions on Russia because of its 2014 takeover of Crimea. Russia also has continued its military support for rebels in eastern Ukraine. The Western measures have cut off Russian banks from international credit. The value of the ruble has dropped from 30 to the U.S. dollar to about 75. Inflation was a major concern for Russians last year. On average, prices increased at a rate of 15% in 2015. Yet consumer food prices increased between 20% and 30%. High inflation for staple products has hurt Russia's poor. The number of Russians below subsistence poverty rose to more than 20 million last year from 18 million a year earlier. Prime Minister Medvedev said the result of inflation was a fall in real incomes. Many people have become poorer, he said, and the middle class has suffered. And this is probably one of the most painful after-effects of the last years. Government officials have said they expect the economy to improve this year. They predict that inflation will drop below 10% in February. Medvedev praised his government's plan for reducing shocks from overseas. He added that the economy was not in tatters. Russia is in the top 10 countries with the lowest public debt and greatest foreign exchange reserves. And that really provides for the resilience of our financial system, he said. The Prime Minister admitted the federal government would likely face budget cuts. About half of Russia's budget depends on oil export revenues. Russia's 2016 budget was made in October, when oil was selling for $50 a barrel. Many observers say the more likely price is between $30 and $40, and could even drop below $20. And that's the Economics Report. I'm Mario Ritter.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The Spanish-American War took place in the late 1800s during the administration of President William McKinley. This week in our series, Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant tell the story of that war.
Unlike other presidents of the late 1800s, William McKinley spent much of his presidency dealing with foreign policy. The most serious problem involved Spain. Spain ruled Cuba at that time. Cuban rebels had started a fight for independence. The Spanish government promised the Cuban people equal rights and self-rule, but in the future. The rebels did not want to wait. President McKinley felt Spain should be left alone to honor its promises. He also felt responsible for protecting the lives and property of Americans in Cuba. When riots broke out in Havana, he ordered the battleship Maine to sail there. One night in early 1898, a powerful explosion sank the Maine. More than 250 American sailors died. There was some evidence the explosion was caused by an accident in the ship's fuel tanks. But many Americans blamed Spain. They demanded war to free Cuba and make it independent.
President McKinley had a difficult decision to make. He did not want war. As he told a friend, "I fought in our civil war. I saw the dead piled up. I do not want to see that again." But McKinley also knew many Americans wanted war. If he refused to fight Spain, his Republican Party could lose popular support. So he did not ask Congress for a declaration of war right away. He sent a message to the Spanish government instead. McKinley demanded an immediate ceasefire in Cuba. He also offered his help in ending the revolt. By the time Spain agreed to the demands, McKinley had made his decision. He asked Congress for permission to use military force to bring peace to Cuba. Congress agreed. It also demanded that Spain withdraw from Cuba and give up all claims to the island. The president signed the congressional resolution. The Spanish government immediately broke relations. On April 25, 1898, the United States declared war on Spain.
The American Navy was ready to fight. It was three times bigger than the Spanish Navy. It also was better trained. A shipbuilding program begun 15 years earlier had made the American Navy one of the strongest in the world. Its ships were made of steel and carried powerful guns. Part of the American Navy at that time was based in Hong Kong. The rest was based on the Atlantic coast of the United States. Admiral George Dewey commanded the Pacific Fleet. Dewey had received a message from the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Theodore Roosevelt. "If war broke out," it said, "he was to attack the Spanish naval force in the Philippines." The Spanish force was commanded by Admiral Patricio Montojo.
The American fleet arrived in Manila Bay on May 1st. It sailed toward the line of Spanish ships. The Spanish fired first. The shells missed. When the two naval forces were 5,000 meters apart, Admiral Dewey ordered the Americans to fire. After 3 hours, Admiral Montojo surrendered. Most of his ships were sunk. 400 of his men were dead or wounded. American land forces arrived several weeks later. They captured Manila, giving the United States control of the Philippines.
Dewey was suddenly a hero. Songs and poems were written about him. Congress gave him special honors. A spirit of victory spread across the nation. People called for an immediate invasion of Cuba. Unlike the Navy, America's army was not ready to fight. When war was declared, the army had only about 25,000 men. Within a few months, however, it had more than 200,000. The soldiers trained at camps in the southern United States. One of the largest camps was in Florida. Cuba is just 150 kilometers off the coast of Florida.
2 weeks after the Spanish-American War began, the Army sent a small force to Cuba. The force was ordered to inspect the north coast of Cuba and to take supplies to Cuban rebels. That invasion failed, but the second one succeeded. 400 American soldiers landed with guns, bullets, and supplies for the rebels. Next, the Army planned to send 25,000 men to Cuba. Their goal was the port of Santiago on the south coast. American ships had trapped a Spanish naval force there earlier. One of the commanders of the big American invasion force was Theodore Roosevelt. Roosevelt had resigned as Assistant Secretary of the Navy when the war started. He organized a group of horse soldiers. Most of the men were cowboys from America's Southwest. They could ride and shoot well. Some were rich young men from New York who simply shared Roosevelt's love of excitement. The group became known as Roosevelt's Rough Riders.
As the Americans landed near Santiago, Spanish forces withdrew to positions outside the city. The strongest force was at San Juan Hill. The Spanish soldiers used smokeless gunpowder. This made their artillery hard to find. The Americans did not have the smokeless powder, but they had Gatling machine guns, which poured a stream of bullets at the enemy. When the machine guns opened fire, American soldiers began moving up San Juan Hill. Several American reporters watched. Later, one of them wrote this report: "I have seen many pictures of the charge on San Juan Hill, but none seem to show it as I remember it. In the pictures, the men are running up the hill quickly in straight lines. There seem to be so many men that no enemy could stand against them." "In fact," said the reporter, "there were not many men, and they moved up the hill slowly, in a close group, not in a straight line. It seemed as if someone had made a terrible mistake. One wanted to call to these few soldiers to come back.
The American soldiers were not called back. They reached the top of San Juan Hill. The Spanish soldiers fled. "All we have to do," an American officer said, "is hold on to the hill, and Santiago will be ours." American Commander General William Shafter sent a message to Spanish Commander General José Toral. Shafter demanded Toral's surrender. While he waited for an answer, the Spanish naval force tried to break out of Santiago Harbor. The attempt failed, and the Americans took control of the port. The loss destroyed any hope that Spain could win the war. There was now no way it could send more soldiers and supplies to Cuba. General Toral agreed to a short ceasefire so women and children could leave Santiago. But he rejected General Shafter's demand of unconditional surrender. American artillery then attacked Santiago. General Toral defended the city as best he could. Finally, on July 17th, he surrendered. The United States promised to send all his soldiers back to Spain.
In the next few weeks, American forces occupied Puerto Rico and the Philippine capital of Manila. America's war with Spain was over. It had lasted just 10 weeks. The next step was to negotiate terms of a peace treaty. The negotiations would be held in Paris. The victorious United States demanded independence for Cuba. It demanded control over Puerto Rico and Guam, and it demanded the right to occupy Manila. The two sides agreed quickly on the terms concerning Cuba, Puerto Rico, and Guam, but they could not agree on what to do about the Philippines. Spain rejected the American demand for control. It did not want to give up this important colony. Negotiations on this point of the peace treaty lasted for days. That will be our story next week.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and images at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.